Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Clay Risen. He's a reporter and editor at the New York Times and author of The Crowded Hour, Theodore Roosevelt and the Rough Riders. Clay's a member of the Society of American Historians and author of two other acclaimed books on American history, A Nation on Fire, America in the Wake of the King Assassination, and The Bill of the Century, The Epic Battle for the Civil Rights Act. Today we're talking about Clay Risen's latest book, Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. Welcome to the exchange, Clay.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, I want to first acknowledge that the testimonials for this book are quite impressive, led by a name many of our listeners will be familiar with, Rachel Maddow. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Well, what inspired you to write it?
You know, several of my earlier books, particularly the King book and the Civil Rights Act book, they all take place after World War II and, after the Red Scare. And as I was thinking about that time and trying to think of a new book project, it occurred to me that, one thing that sort of runs through implicitly a lot of the stories I'd worked on and other books from that era is this legacy of the Red Scare and almost like this kind of dark matter shaping subsequent historical events and trends without ever really being stated. And so it sort of struck me that, well, here's this thing. We sort of know that this is, something that affected presidential decisions and shaped or distorted movements like the Civil Rights Movement. And so I thought, well, this would be a really good subject to attack or to dig into, especially because, I think a lot of people maybe know generally what the Red Scare was, but, a lot of people don't know all that went into it and how it's all connected. And they might know the story of Oppenheimer. They might know, the story of the Hollywood blacklists, but there's so much more. And these are all part of one story.
Well, that's a good point because we're three generations down the line and our history lessons are not that great in our schools. So before we dive into your book, remind our listeners who Joseph McCarthy was and the definition of McCarthyism.
Yeah, so Joseph McCarthy was a first-term senator from Wisconsin. He was a Republican. And in 1950, he began a four-year campaign to what, in his words, were rout out a communist conspiracy from the highest levels of the federal government. And there was no conspiracy, but that didn't stop him from lashing out, lobbying accusations, baseless claims, at mid-level bureaucrats, at high-ranking generals, at all kinds of targets. And he was, because of the moment and because of this hysteria around communism, he was able to get away with things that in retrospect seemed just unbelievable. And so the definition of McCarthyism is basically that, is the use of baseless accusations trumped up by fears of the other, of conspiracies, of what have you, to gain political points. And that's what McCarthy was able to do for 4 years.
So the McCarthy era of the 1950s came on the heels of the Great Sedition Trial in 1944 during World War II. And in that trial, a couple dozen members of Congress were indicted for peddling Nazi propaganda. And then prior to that era, you write about a KKK member being elected mayor of Los Angeles. And of course, here in Oregon during that time, the Klan had a stronghold on local and state politics throughout the early 20th century. So we're not talking about a 20th century America that many folks today are remembering as great, are we?
No. It is important to keep in mind that America is, very much more than what our history books tell us about. And, there are a lot of elements of this history that are brushed aside or forgotten because of, the kind of dominant narrative that we tell ourselves about progress and about enlightenment and moderation and consensus. And, those things are part of the story, but there's much more to it. And, as you mentioned, there's a long history of right-wing violence and right-wing mobilization, far-right mobilization that, has been hidden. And at the same time, there's a long history of conspiracy mongering, especially against the left in America, of which the Red Scare is the shining example.
Well, it's interesting because we seem to have peddled a false narrative about what America is, what it was, and what it is today. And ironically, Trump supporters today who want to make America great again actually despise the era of the Great Society around the era that they think America was great. It seems
well, that's true.
Ridiculous.
I mean, yeah, no, I mean, I am one, and I think who believes, and I think there's the evidence bears this out, that, you know, the great progress that was made by the United States in the 20th century, you know, is largely the story of, you know, an activist government that not only helped the poorest and the least fortunate in America to make it into, you know, to succeed, to survive. So building out, you know, a strong middle class in America, that wouldn't have happened without the New Deal and the Great Society, you know, but also that these things are not, you know, mutually exclusive, that you can have a strong market and you can have strong industry with strong government support. In fact, that is the success story of especially the post-war era of, you know, government subsidizing highways and research projects and, you know, all kinds of developments that, as you say, you know, today are sort of lauded as this great era, but one that is completely ahistorical in its remembrance.
Another thing that we tend to do is place labels on our ideological beliefs. And so when we talk about politics, there are all these labels: fascism, communism, socialism. Let's define our terms. What is fascism? What is communism? What is socialism?
Oh, well, good questions. I mean, to me personally, fascism is, you know, it's an anti-democratic movement or ideology that attempts to create a faux populism based around an appeal to nationalism, an appeal to the exclusion of certain groups and the oppression of certain groups, and at the same time creates a unity with, you know, with a corporate class, with, you know, the depending on the society, the aristocracy, you know, it's this sort of, to me, fascism is fundamentally built on a lie, right? That, and you see this in Italy, for example, or in Nazi Germany, this idea that it's all about the people, when in fact, it's very much about oppressing the people. You know, socialism, something very different. Socialism believes in fundamentally in democracy and in, to some extent, a democratic market, you know, free market, but one that is very much hemmed in by a powerful state. And so lots of functions of the market in a more traditional liberal society, you know, say transportation, healthcare, you know, finance, banking, you know, are controlled by the state. And communism is, to some extent, an extreme version of that, although fundamentally different, because it's one that's not democratic in the way that we understand it. And it does not give room to any kind of private property or free market or any kind of market really at all. And it's, you know, basically, that's the idea behind communism. And it's, you know, as it's defined, it's the power of the people. But, you know, in practice, it ultimately becomes, you know, a one-party state where individual expression is repressed in favor of, well, in favor of the state and in favor of, you know, an overwhelming, all-encompassing ideology. And communism, to me, ultimately becomes synonymous with totalitarianism.
My guest is Clay Risen, author of Red Scare, Blacklist, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. Clay, could you read us a bit of excerpt from your introduction?
Certainly. There was substance to concerns about Soviet infiltration, but it remained clear that the response, in the form of blacklists and congressional investigations and book bans and loyalty tests, went so far beyond what was necessary that something else was in the mix. Explaining that something else became a driving force for this book. Cultural change cannot be tracked linearly or clearly. Rather, it is genealogical, with traces of genetic bits passing down through the ages, even as it incorporates new material. In the same way, my children look and act like themselves, but also like their Scottish and Eastern European ancestors. It is my premise in this book that something similar can be said about the Red Scare. That it ended for most Americans, there is no question. But it didn't end for everyone. The fact that diehard McCarthyites and other anti-communists found themselves shut out of mainstream politics by the late 1950s only added to their conviction that a great conspiracy was afoot. That sort of passion does not go away.
So you open the story in your book with Helen Reed Bryan. Who is she and what happened to her?
So Helen Reed Bryan was the executive secretary of a small nonprofit called the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee. And what that meant was they helped people who were victims of refugees from the Spanish Civil War. And these were people who sided against Franco and ended up having to flee the country after Franco took power as, you know, a fascist leader. And mostly what they were trying to do was help these people who were in refugee camps and mostly in France try to get to places like Mexico and Cuba that were willing to take them. This was, you know, an admittedly, you know, pretty progressive left-wing group. It was anti-fascist in its definition. It also worked closely with communists. It took money from the Communist Party. And in this way, it was not unique. There were a lot of organizations like this, especially in the 1930s, in this era when labels didn't matter as much. And there was a kind of unity, a real unity across the left. And Helen Bryan was never a communist. She was, you know, someone who believed very much in American freedom, but she was very progressive. And when she took over this organization, not long after she took over, she was called down to Congress. This is in early 1946. And the House Un-American Activities Committee demanded that she hand over all the papers, all the records of her organization. Now, they claimed that her organization was communist. She said it wasn't, and she refused to hand over the papers. As a result, she was convicted of contempt of Congress and sent to prison. And she was the first of many, many people during the Red Scare who stood up, refused to collaborate with Congress, refused to go along with HUAC, and were punished for it. And her life was largely destroyed. After she got out of prison, she couldn't find a job. The FBI hounded her. She had health problems, and she ended up in early retirement in a small town in Vermont where the FBI still came and hounded her. And, you know, to me, she is one story. There are many people like her. But in her early conviction, she was really the first victim of the Red Scare. But also in her defiance, her unwillingness to go along, to me, she speaks volumes about what was at stake during the Red Scare, the lie that underwrote the Red Scare, and ultimately the cost of the Red Scare that so many Americans bore.
Well, we have about a minute left before we have to take a break. Can you talk a little bit about the House on Un-American Activities?
Yeah, so, you know, often referred to by its name, by its, you know, its short name, HUAC. You know, it started off actually as a largely anti-fascist organization, but was soon taken over by anti-communist conspiracy theorists in Congress. And then after the war, it became the vehicle for witch hunting. It became the vehicle for going after Hollywood. For going after journalists and union workers. I mean, you can go down, there's a long, long list of organizations, areas of American life that HUAC dug into, ostensibly looking for communists, but really looking to police progressivism and to attack progressivism as a movement in America.
Well, you quote the screenwriter, Walter Bernstein, who wrote, quote, "The communists had led the anti-fascist fight. They had led the fight against racism and colonialism. They dared and sacrificed the most," end quote. Is this why the Communist Party was attractive to Black leaders like W.B. Du Bois?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody had their own reasons, but it's certainly true that, you know, look, communism to most Americans was a very unappealing ideology, and you know, I think ultimately was revealed to be totalitarian in its fundamental nature. But what the communist movement did in the 1930s and the 40s looked very different to many Americans.
Okay, hold it right there. I want to leave that cliffhanger. We have to take a quick break, but I want you to talk about that on the other side.
Okay.
My guest is Clay Risen, author of Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Clay Risen, author of Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. So before the break, you were telling us how different communism looked back in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, so for a lot of Americans who, you know, were really at the grassroots level and maybe were in other movements, you know, the labor movement, the civil rights movement, you know, a lot of them saw communism in a much better light. They saw the communists as organizers, as, you know, tireless advocates of their causes. Maybe they didn't see the whole picture of what communism really meant, but they saw a more appealing version. And, you know, like the quote you read from Bernstein, that was what a lot of Americans saw. And, you know, especially in the 30s. And so their willingness to work alongside the Communist Party, and in some cases to join the party, you know, were motivated not by a fundamental opposition to American values, but in this belief that, you know, the communists were working toward the same end as they were.
So they're fighting against racism, they're fighting against colonialism, they're fighting against white supremacy. And so the Communist Party was the party that was doing this work. Now, you described the construct of the Communist Party from its political committee leaders down to its lowest ranks. Tell us about that.
So the Communist Party was a party like any other. So it had a leadership core and, you know, then on down to the individual branches. And, you know, these branches were in neighborhoods and cities around the country, although mostly, you know, on the coasts in the big cities and then places like Chicago and Detroit, industrial cities. And the leadership itself was much more in tune with Soviet communism, what was going on in the Soviet Union. You know, it was very committed to carrying out what Joseph Stalin commanded. And, you know, that did in some ways trickle down, depending on where you were, to the rank and file. Sometimes it didn't. And so, you know, it sort of is not something that you can tar with a broad brush when you say, you know, these people were communists and then therefore they were anti-American because they listened to what they followed what Joseph Stalin said. But the party itself, as a at the very top, was very much in the pocket of the Soviet Union, and it took money from the Soviet communists and facilitated espionage. They were not good actors in that regard. And so it becomes this very complicated picture when you start to talk about after World War II, how does America, that's now in the Cold War, in this ideological conflict with communist Soviet Union, you know, how does it deal with communism at home? And how does it also protect civil liberties? And, you know, regardless of what your political views are, you have a right to express them in America. And how do you safeguard that while still paying attention to national security? And this is a really important question. And yet during the Red Scare, that question was largely thrown out the window in favor of a kind of rabid security at all costs, you know, damn the torpedoes kind of approach, so that people who had ever even expressed any kind of sympathy with communism or simply had, you know, friends who were communists or siblings or parents, you know, suddenly they were suspect and were liable to lose their livelihoods.
So it sounds like you're talking about control over an ideological belief. And you talk about the relationship between Hollywood, which tells powerful stories and has a great influence on America, and also had a relationship with communism.
Yeah, so Hollywood in the 1930s did have a very large, or relatively large, so it's not actually that large, but relatively large Communist Party. And a lot of people who sympathized, you know, again, with what the Communist Party was selling. So particularly during the Spanish Civil War, the communists claimed to be speaking for the anti-Franco forces, and they raised a lot of money in Hollywood. The presence of that party in Hollywood led to a backlash. And during the early days face of the Red Scare, in, you know, essentially became a big target for HUAC. And in 1947, HUAC famously called 10 screenwriters and producers and directors to Congress, and they subpoenaed them and tried to force them to talk about their political beliefs. And they all refused, and they all went to jail for that. And they became known as the Hollywood 10. But that was only the beginning of HUAC's war on Hollywood. They later came back and did the same thing to actors and actresses and more directors and screenwriters.
Yeah, some of them were very famous, like Lucille Ball, Humphrey Bogart, Gene Kelly.
Yeah, yeah. And not everybody was sent to jail. I mean, a lot of people avoided it. You know, by the early 50s, it was kind of almost this sort of performative thing that, you know, you would be called and you had to say certain things. And, you know, hopefully you wouldn't have to say anything that betrayed trust or what have you. Maybe you could avoid doing it. You could write a letter. I found, you know, dozens of letters from famous actors and actresses, Kirk Douglas and Vincent Price and Lena Horne, you know, all trying to explain away their previous affiliations with left-wing groups. And yeah, and it was a way for HUAC to raise its visibility, to stay relevant, but it was also an expression of this rabid, this kind of unhinged belief that communism was using Hollywood as a propaganda tool to infiltrate the American mind, which is, you know, just ridiculous. There was never any evidence that that was ever a plan, or that there was some conspiracy in Hollywood to do that. And at the end of the day, Hollywood was controlled by large studios and executives who had absolutely no interest in currying favor with communism. And they were
much more conservative.
Yeah, they were very conservative.
And a famous actor you talked about, Ronald Reagan, was working with J. Edgar Hoover over at the FBI to name his fellow actors, and they're the ones that were carted before Congress.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Reagan was someone who had started off fairly liberal, and, you know, he made this, when he became a politician, he made this a big talking point, was, you know, he had been a liberal, and then because of his exposure to communism in Hollywood, decided that it was this great threat to American society. And, you know, it's funny the way he talked about it, and the way that a lot of people talked about it. You know, ultimately, communism was not, you know, there was no threat of communism taking over American society or really having any influence at all. And yet that was the justification for this backlash that did much more damage to American life than communism ever could. And that's setting aside, of course, I mean, communist spies and espionage is a separate thing, but this idea that the party was somehow going to take over America was a fever dream.
Well, this wasn't the first Red Scare. There was one before that. Talk about that one.
Yeah, so there was a Red Scare after World War I. And in that case, it was, you know, very much tied into kind of general xenophobia, backlash against immigrants who, you know, in the previous half century had flooded into America, had really rewritten the face of American life. And a lot of them were, you know, coming for the American dream. Now, what happened was, you know, there was a small number who were active in left-wing radical causes. Some of them were communists, others were anarchists or you know, various other splinter groups. And so they were targeted after World War I as being uniquely threatening to American life. And hundreds of them were deported. There were raids across particularly the big cities and the Northeast and the Great Lakes. Many of them were led by J. Edgar Hoover's new Bureau of Investigation and this radical division that he had helped build. And the Red Scare, the first Red Scare, ended relatively quickly, but it left behind this residue, this sort of architecture around the FBI and other sort of, you know, legal instruments that became critical parts of what enabled the second Red Scare to be so extensive.
My guest is Clay Risen, author of Red Scare, Blacklist, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. So how did the Red Scare give birth to the new right and what's known as Trumpism today?
Well, I think there are lots of things that go into that, but I think that there's a thread that one can pull through from the Red Scare to today. The main thing, I think, is this fundamental belief in a conspiracy at the heart of the American left. This, you know, this predicated on this belief that liberal, progressive beliefs in America, progressive ideas, are somehow anti-American and sinister. And, you know, this was very much a trope during the Red Scare, this idea that things like, universal health care and the New Deal were un-American and were being implemented by a cabal, like this conspiracy of faceless bureaucrats in the federal government. And this was at the heart of Joe McCarthy's charges against the State Department or against the Department of Justice or what have you.
That's the deep state.
Yeah, yeah, right. I mean, at the time, they didn't have the term, but it's what they talked about. They meant the deep state. And, you know, the Red Scare ended for a variety of reasons that, you know, I lay out in the book, but this belief did not end. And there were a lot of people after McCarthy was censured and then he died in 1957, you know, a lot of people believed that he was right and that he had lost. He was a martyr. And this was a pretty fringe idea, this set of ideas, but it maintained itself. It stayed alive on the fringe. And then, you know, would come back into American mainstream life at various points. I mean, you can see the same idea, the same set of ideas behind Senator Goldwater's run for president in 1964. You can see it again in, you know, various Nazi white supremacist groups that pop up and, you know, starting in the 1970s and 80s. You can see it in Pat Buchanan's nativist movement in the 1990s and his run for president. And I think you see it in elements of Trumpism today. I mean, this idea that there is this anti-American cabal at the heart of society, at the heart of government and you know, the elite levels of America, and that something radical has to be done to root them out. And I think you see in the second Trump administration really the apotheosis of all this. I mean, McCarthy was never, he wasn't president, he was only a senator, but he dreamed of being able to do this and to be in a position where Trump is today. And so did Buchanan, and so did Goldwater. And now I think you're seeing this play out, and whether you look at, you know, the actions of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and his, you know, evisceration of, you know, the FDA and the CDC, you know, you can go down the list and you can see this sort of implementation of a very radical agenda that's premised on this idea that everything that's, you know, vast elements of the federal government are anti-American and are sinister and have to be removed by any means necessary.
What similarities did you find between Vice President J.D. Vance and Senator Joseph McCarthy?
You know, there was something last year that Vance said that really struck me as very McCarthyite. And this was right around, this was in when the whole Haitian immigrants are eating dogs and cats in Springfield, Ohio, when that popped up. Just completely debased, right? None of that happened. And it was clear at the time that it didn't happen. But it was this conspiracy theory or this fraud largely on the right in right-wing media. And, you know, responsible journalists would ask Senator Vance, who represented Ohio, Senator at the time, you know, these are false accusations. Why are you spreading them? And he said two things that were really struck me as right from the toolbox of Joseph McCarthy. The first thing he said was, it's not my responsibility to say what is right and wrong. It's your responsibility as the press to hold me to account. And, you know, this idea that he had no responsibility to the truth was something McCarthy would say all the time. McCarthy would lob crazy accusations and then say, well, I'm just repeating what I've been told. It's up to you to decide. And, you know, sort of giving himself free rein to lie and to spread unbased rumors. And the other thing that he said, that Senator Vance said, that I thought was very McCarthyite, you know, the same question. How can you spread these rumors that you know are not true? And he said, look, it doesn't actually matter whether what I say on one story or the other is true, because the overall point is true. And what he meant, he didn't really elaborate, but it's clear what he meant was, you know, that immigrants are bad, that we have to get rid of immigrants. And if the sum total of his accusations was to make Americans want to get rid of immigrants, then what he was saying story to story, you know, these baseless accusations were justified. And that was something also that McCarthy said over and over. You know, he said, look, it doesn't matter what, you know, maybe I'm wrong on this person or that person, maybe, you know, but the point is that I have to get rid of this conspiracy theory, which sort of begs the question, right? If there's no conspiracy theory, what is he, you know, how is he justified?
Well, these are the same folks who want to control the narrative in our schools, in our libraries, in our museums, even on public media. And you're saying that there's no truth in these people.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's important to point that out, because during the Red Scare, just like today, there's a big fight over schools and over curriculums and over, you know, basically the stories that we tell our children, you know, to put it in one way. And the accusation that, you know, that the left is spreading lies, and that therefore, you know, here's this other narrative that therefore must be true, which is, you know, I think a pretty flawed way of looking at things. But, you know, during the Red Scare, you had people who banned books, who prosecuted or persecuted teachers, who maybe were pro civil rights or said things that were suspicious in the eyes of activists. Just like today, children are encouraged to rat on their teachers if they hear something that they think is questionably progressive. And all of this is to the same end, right? Is to control the narrative and to control the way knowledge is created and passed on. And, you know, I think that's what fundamentally is, you know, one of the core parts of the Red Scare, and a story that I try to tell extensively in the book, but also it's something that we see today.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, and I'm going to encourage our listeners to get this book. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thank you, Clay.
All right. Thank you.
My guest was Clay Risen, author of Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. I'm Mike Green.